Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. I got a question for you. Does it rain only on Earth? That's one of the topics that you can talk about with our weather guys. We've got a weather guy so far. We've got John Martin with us. Steve Ackerman, who's Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. Pretty sure we'll be joining in. We're trying to get a hold of him right now. He's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, at which, of course, John Martin is as well. And great to have John with us, and I'm sure we'll get Steve sooner or later here. But as we continue to visit with John, what do you want to know about weather on planet Earth? What spring weather questions or observations do you have? You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And John, you know, we had Bill emailed a question. It came sort of near the end of our conversation about history, but I think it relates to this show too, this portion of the program. He's wondering about the temperature that weather balloons recorded when all the jet planes were grounded immediately after 9/11.
Temperatures, huh?
Yeah,
the balloons. The balloons still went up. I don't think there was anything that, I don't think anybody's put any scrutiny to that question, because there was no expectation that the temperature of the atmosphere at a variety of different levels would so quickly respond to a lack of some of the cirrus clouds that can be produced by jet planes. So I don't know if there's been any sort of look at that question. Surface temperatures was an interesting question. As one of our colleagues up at Whitewater, I think, did some work on that in 2001, where if you put these cirrus clouds from contrails up in the sky, they tend to radiate at very cold temperatures, and so they might make it a little bit warmer on the ground. And when they're absent, you might get a little bit cooler overnight, low temperatures. And that, in fact, was something that came out of his analysis and was statistically significant. But temperatures at variety of other elevations, I don't think there's quite enough individual observations to really, you know, come up with any strong conclusion. It might be the reason why no one's looked at that. But I suspect it's not a really major factor.
We've got Steve Ackerman on by phone. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be there. Sorry I'm a little late. I kind of had a little problems with, calling in, you know, what today's world is like.
Yeah, that's right. And man, it's miserable, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's dive into, I mentioned to start this portion of the show that we were going to talk about whether or not rain is unique to planet Earth. Is rain unique to planet Earth?
And I wouldn't necessarily say rain is unique to planet Earth, but I would say precipitation is not unique to planet Earth. So other planets do have precipitation, and by that I mean particles falling from clouds and reaching the ground. In Earth, they're made of water, either liquid water or frozen water, ice, in terms of snow fall. But on other planets, precipitation does occur. For example, on Venus, it rains or precipitates sulfuric acid. So the droplets there are not made of water. They're made of sulfuric acid. So it depends on the composition. In Mars, there's dry ice. It snows dry ice. So carbon dioxide that's frozen in a solid state. Moon of Saturn, we also think it precipitates methane. And in Jupiter, it precipitates helium drops, or it looks like ammonia hailstones. So it definitely precipitates on other planets. It's just not the kind of precipitation that you want to melt and drink.
Or be under.
Under, for that matter, right?
Oh, my goodness me. Oh, let's take some calls. Cindy in Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Yes, a friend sent me a video of a cloud avalanche in Nepal, and the sky was a beautiful clear blue. So what would cause that to happen?
A cloud avalanche?
Yeah, what's that?
Yeah, you know, I actually saw that video, and it's an avalanche. So it's the snow on the ground that's up high, and then it gets disturbed, and it, you know, comes rumbling down the mountain. And as it does that, the snow that's falling down, you know, gets picked up into the sky and forms what looks like, at least in that video to me, looks like, you know, thunderstorm type clouds. And that's because that falling snow, that avalanche of snow, is very turbulent. And so, you know, it forms that cloud looking type activity. But, you know, the video, at least the one that I saw, man, that was pretty scary. And, you know, avalanches are pretty destructive. I know we lived in Colorado for a while. And when you would go cross-country skiing in the back areas of Rocky Mountain Park, they always had avalanche warnings up and also lessons of how to, if you got caught in one, how you might survive or try and survive.
Oh, well, Cindy, thank you for that question. Appreciate it. Rich in Burlington, Wisconsin, will give you a chance. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really enjoyed the program today. I love historical information relating to weather and weathering predicting. A fan of Snowflake Bentley and Eric Sloan. But I am also a retired science teacher, taught undergraduate meteorology, and then for 34 years, tried to get my high school students excited about looking at the sky and telling the weather, getting them looking out at the natural indicators to predict weather. And I've had a concern about the fact that now my students will look at the phone and forget about the sky, and that will give them, you know, great success at predicting the weather because they'll know what it is next week, next tomorrow, simply by looking at their phone. And do your guests think this is as ominous as I'm thinking it's going to be in terms of getting young people to look out at the sky?
Absolutely. Hallelujah. I am 100% in agreement with you on that. I think we got a crisis that's looming, which is the inability to distinguish between information, knowledge, and wisdom. And those are three different steps on the path that a person takes that are kind of generated by curiosity. So looking at your phone is purely information. That's not what makes your heart beat. You got to learn why things work. That's knowledge. And then when you know a lot about certain set of things, you have some wisdom about them. So I couldn't agree more, sir. I think 100% in agreement with you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell a little story that backs up John's belief that we need to be looking up. And that has to do with about a year ago or 2 years ago, I was driving into campus. And I pass a bus stop, and as I'm driving, you know, there's a really interesting cloud formation up in the sky. And as I drive by this bus stop, which has probably 10 people waiting, I notice that there's only one person in that bus stop looking up, and it's John. Everybody else is looking down or looking around, and John is just up looking at the sky, wondering what is forming those clouds.
That's a great story.
With a confederacy of nerds.
Confederacy of nerds.
Oh, Rich, thanks for that call. And I think you're right. And you're getting some agreement here from our weather guys. Thank you. Well, Rick in Elkhart Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I've had a question I've thought about for some time. I'm wondering, when they measure the amount of CO2 going into the atmosphere every year, what are they actually measuring? Is it the amount of the weight of the smoke or the CO2 molecule? Or are they measuring, let's say you burn a ton of coal, they say, well, that's a ton of CO2 going into the atmosphere. What are they actually measuring when they say these billions of tons of CO2 going into the atmosphere every year?
Yeah, it's go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say there's probably two aspects to this. One is when we talk about the measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, they're actually measuring the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So they're looking at either the weight of the carbon monoxide relative to other molecules in the atmosphere, or they're looking at it as a concentration of carbon dioxide in comparison to the other gases that are in the atmosphere. And then, you know, to try and validate where that's coming from, then they look at burning of fossil fuels and how much carbon dioxide would come from the burning of fossil fuels and try to look for consistency between what we're observing in the atmosphere as well as what's being burnt, as well as what's being taken out of the atmosphere by plants and such.
Perfect. Thank you, Ron, for that question. Appreciate it. Rick, I'm sorry. Ron, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Years ago, I read that one of the satellites observing Venus had a very high reflection of some of their radar pulses. And so they decided that the highlands that they were observing were covered with snow. And when they started analyzing what the temperatures were and which substances it might be, they concluded it was lead and bismuth, like in Pepto-Bismol, that these elements must have been evaporating or subliming from lower levels. And then they were so concentrated in the atmosphere that when they raised up, they produced snow, just like the Pineapple Express, you know, in the Pacific Ocean, when it's pushed up over the Sierra Nevada, it dumps feet of snow. This apparently was dumping lead and bismuth on the highlands of Venus. Have either of you or any of you ever heard of that?
Steve?
No, I had not heard of that, but it's fascinating. I'll have to look for it, do a search on some of the NASA sites. But, you know, what it does show, back to our earlier question about precipitation, the precipitation on some of these other planets is can be very complicated chemically, whereas a lot of our precipitation is primarily associated with water. And I say primarily because there could be other substances that serve as seeding sites for the droplet or the ice crystal to grow. But what you're explaining there is very different than seeding a particle developing.
I think. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Ron, thank you very much for calling. Our weather guys are with us, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve's also Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. They're staying with us right up till 12:30 today. So you'll be able to join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back right after the news. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at weather and climate now with our weather guys, John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So, with spring weather questions, which ones do you have? What do you want to know about the weather and climate in Wisconsin right now? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have Jan from Eau Claire online, so let's go there. Jan, hi. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call.
Well, this may not be a spring weather question. It may be more winter related.
That's all right.
I hope so. When I am outside on a cold day, I can see my breath, which I've assumed is related to the water vapor that I'm exhaling, and it makes fog or a cloud in the cold air. When I go for a walk, I'm in a rural area, so I walk along the side of the roads. No sidewalks here. On a day that is not quite so cold, perhaps 40 degrees, if I am passed by a truck or a bus, I can see my breath then, even though I can't see it at other times. Is the air colder in the wash behind a truck? Why does that happen?
Well, that's really interesting. I'm going to guess the following reason. That fog that you see when you breathe is called a mixing fog. And actually, that happens naturally as well. There's a certain type of fog that's called a mixing fog when you mix two different air masses. And in this case, it's the environmental air mixing with the air that's coming out as your lungs, as you mentioned. So I would guess that if you're walking along the road and as a truck goes by, then you could see your breath, that the truck, the airflow behind the truck might be sucking in air from the environment off the road, which may be cooler and maybe even more moist than what the roadway is.
That sounds like a really good guess to me. What do you think, John?
I think that's a very good guess. I was going to suggest something that's not exactly that, but related to the stirring of the air that's a result of the bus going by. Maybe there's little vortices on the backside of the bus.
Yeah.
And they may actually have little columns of updraft of air. And that might be enough also to get, you might be so close to saturation that you just need a little bit of updraft to get you there. I don't know if that's it, but I like Steve's idea better than the one I had. So that's probably right.
So there you go, Jan.
On the theme of mixing, right? Yeah. It's all about the mixing of the environmental air with the air, with the breath.
Yeah.
Interesting. Jan, that's thanks.
Very awesome. What a great observation.
I was thinking the same thing, John. Yeah. What a great observation to make while you're going on a walk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, man. Thank you again, Jan. Mary in the town of Lebanon, Wisconsin. Hi.
Yeah, well, I'm commenting one about the winds. I think we've had so much strong wind. I've never seen so much. And we've got cedar trees and junipers. I have so much, you know, plus pine, different pine trees. I have so many pieces of pine, all evergreen trees all over our yard. To me, the winds have been so strong this winter and this spring. And my other comment is about looking at the sky. Well, I live along the Rock River and so on, but I mean, I can look. My husband's father would always say, red sun in the morning, sailor, take warning. And so I always am watching the sky. And when it looks really dark to the north or south, and I'm looking at the radar to see, is it snowing there or is it raining there?
I think there's a couple of things that you're bringing up there, Mary, and that is that, it's great to look up, right? You can learn a lot. You can see a lot. The sky is beautiful as well. But then you're also coupling that with your radar image, right? So you could see the sky, looks like something's coming at you, but you can't see it. And so you fire up your radar app and look at your phone and you can see what's coming at you. So you need to do both, not one or the other, I'd say.
And what about wind? Are we windier than we've been, or is this normal this time of year?
I don't know if there's been any systematic increase in the wind from year to year, but maybe this has been an unusually windy March and April. I don't know the numbers on that, and I certainly don't know them for the locality around Lebanon. So that's hard to say. It could very well be the case, though. You know, there's ups and downs in all kinds of weather elements, and sometimes wind is one of them.
Yeah.
And don't we, as we always talk about March winds, isn't it?
Yeah,
it March seems is windier.
I mean, in some ways, March and April have to be windy because otherwise how would pollen spread? Most of it doesn't get spread by bees. It's spread by the wind. So if we have a windless April, I think that's bad for agriculture or at least tree culture, whatever you call that. You know, because they have to make sure that stuff's getting around and the wind helps them do it. So, you know, that's a kind of a perfect timing. March can be a stormy month for sure.
And so that's what makes me sneeze in April is when all that wind is disturbing.
I think so.
Yeah, it's all tree pollen right now.
Yeah.
I've had my two sneezes for the morning so far. Oh, boy. Mary, thanks. Bill in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, thank you. In 2012, there was a drought, and there's some, I'm wondering if there's any truth to these cycles where every 8 to 10 years we go through a wet cycle and then a dry cycle, and are we in fact entering a new dry cycle, and can we expect this spring and summer to be drier than normal?
Hmm.
I don't think there's anything really to that kind of a predictable cycle that's quite like that. That's, you know, sort of an obvious 8 or 9 year cycle. So probably, and I must say it's not my expertise, but I'd say probably that's not going to be a harbinger of what's coming for the coming spring. It's about to get pretty stormy, in my opinion, in the next couple of weeks, but that could be intermittent storminess, so it won't really be dry or wet, perhaps. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Just to go along with that, Jim in Iowa County called. He's a farmer. He noticed that April has been pretty dry in Iowa County in the last couple of years. Not many showers. Is that something climate change is impacting, do you think, or would we know?
That's a really good question. It's been a dry April this year. I don't recall that last year was, but it's in the record, I'm sure, if it was. And this has been a really dry April. I think people are, the average person, sort of, that means me, I don't have a farm, is noticing that even this April. So whether or not that's a climate signal is a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Brad,
I think we've been 15% below normal. Southern Wisconsin is like 50% below normal.
Yeah.
I think northern, most far north Wisconsin, I think is the precipitation is pretty close to average or a little above average. But the southern part of the state and a lot of the Great Lake area states are definitely below average precipitation wise this past month.
Yeah.
Brad in Prairie du Chien had wondered about sun dogs. What does that mean for weather changes when you see one? Does it represent any change or pattern in weather?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. They're formed in cirrus clouds, as I understand it. Steve knows about the optics more than I do, and I'll just comment on the downstream in time consequences. Sometimes when a weather system is approaching you from the south and west, as they often do, then the first line of cloud that comes out is a cirrus cloud at a very high elevation. And so that can sometimes portend that the rest of the system is coming later. And so the clouds will thicken up and you'll get a little bit more likelihood of precipitation. But I don't know if that's the only time you get a sun dog.
Yeah, no, it's not the only time you'll get a sun dog, but it is the classic situation. And it reminds me of my very first meteorology class, where they teach you that structured cloudiness that's associated with the warm front that Matt's talking about. You get your mare's tails, the wispy cirrus, and then you get a very thin cirrus veil where you'll see the halos and the sun dogs. Then that thickens to a cirrus stratus and then an alto stratus, and then you get your precipitation. And I was out shopping, so it was during the break, and it was after the class, and I was shopping with my little sister, and you know, see the halo, pointed it out, went to a store, come out, now the clouds gotten thicker, went to a store, came out, and again, it was just a classic cloud development. And I
That's
said,
great.
Oh boy, it's going to be snowing in about an hour. And she just gave me this look like, you nut.
Yeah.
Sure enough, in an hour, it started to snow. And she thought I was the smartest person in the world.
Wow. That's great. That's
that
the kind of thing you hold on to.
The only time I have seen that classic cloud situation associated with the war front. But the most important time of my life. Yeah.
That's right. The timing was impeccable.
And all the, and you remember that after all these years that I can
after
see
all
why.
These years, I remember that. I remember the stores even.
Oh, man. Brian in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, the reason I called is, well, I was driving home from work and I was hearing your experts talking about kids not having interest in weather and not looking up. And I work for the Horowitz-Zeremer Planetarium in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And we were looking for a project, a meteorology project that maybe the kids could kind of monitor or take part in. And what we're going to do is we're going to take a 36-inch party balloon, attach a small radio transmitter to it, and if all our calculations are right, we should be able to lift that transmitter into the jet stream at about 40,000 feet and hopefully catch a ride around the world. And what we're going to do with all the information that the kids can monitor on the internet as the balloon makes its journey is they can watch where the balloon is going on maps. They can pull up weather apps and see what the wind patterns are at all the different altitudes as the balloon is flying around. And that seems to be our project. So I was wondering if your experts had any thoughts on maybe utilizing something like that.
That sounds like an interesting idea. I will say that your balloon is not going to make it around the world because it's likely to break up before it gets, around the world. I'm not sure when they'll break up, but with weather balloons, we see this frequently. They'll go up and they'll just keep expanding, and then they'll eventually pop and then come down to the ground. So I wouldn't get their anticipations up that they're going to see it circumvent the world.
But it's a pretty cool idea.
It is. It's a cool idea. And if you get lucky and it goes a good distance, I agree with Steve, it's unlikely it'll make it all the way around, of course. Mm-hmm. But if you get a good distance and you actually, you launch the thing in Waukesha and it radios back to you from, Northern Ontario or something the next day, that's pretty exciting. And you can't consider that boring.
So right. Yeah.
That's pretty neat.
That is neat. Brian, thank you. And good luck with that project. You're going to have to call us back again.
Let us know how it works.
Please do. That'd be great to know.
These guys are always on the last Monday of the month. So remember that and call us back and give us a report on what's going on, Brian. Thank you very much for calling. Well, Kel in Sugar Camp, it's your turn. Hi, Kel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been watching radar all winter and spring. I'm always interested in what's going to happen as far as the day goes. And I've been noticing that weather systems look like small hurricanes with an eye and with bands of weather. And they kind of go up and down like on a bell curve as they're going east. But sometimes I saw one this winter that went in a circle around Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Illinois, and to Michigan. And I just was wondering, is this just the way the weather always travels and goes circular systems where you have bands of weather that keep repeating themselves, or is it something that's connected to climate change? Maybe I'm just noticing it now.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, and I'll try my best to make some sense of what I think you might have seen. That sometimes if the regional radar is in the right spot, and the storm is in the right spot to get caught by the regional radar, it can really look like the thing is making westward progress, and it may actually be making westward progress at a certain stage in its life cycle. So it's not impossible that that's the case. It's and most of the time we don't catch storms in this so-called occluded stage, the end of their life cycle. So they do tend to make west to east progress, at least some component of west to east progress. But occasionally you can see them actually moving back to the west. And when they do that, they're going to have this really circular structure, especially on a regional radar. So that might be what you're seeing. It certainly would not be, I don't think, a climate signal. It's more likely the fact that you're becoming a frequent observer of the radar and starting to notice that things are characterized differently from one day to the next, but it's not really a climate thing. But it's an interesting observation.
Yeah, yeah. Kel, thank you for calling. Joe in Ontario, maybe? Wisconsin? Hi, Joe.
Hi, yes, Ontario, Wisconsin. Well, I'm a private pilot, and obviously watch the weather all the time, and I was wondering if your guests have a particular website or weather apps that they feel are better at predicting the weather that they use, and that would be helpful as a private pilot.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think, I usually will go to our atmospheric sciences website, aos.wisc.edu.
Yeah, that's right.
And then there's a lot of information there. Unless I want a short-term precipitation forecast because I'm going to go outside and walk or run or do something. And then I'll go right to a National Weather Service radar app and then look at that directly, because that's just a short-term forecast of when's the precipitation going to get here. And there's a really good one put out by Oklahoma. It's called Radar Scope for that purpose. I use that one a lot for that very short-term forecast.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same recipe I use with almost the same ingredients. I think our department's webpage, aos.wis.edu, has a wealth of information, as Steve says. It's easy to access, too. And then just what Steve said, you know, if I'm looking for 2 days out, I'll look at the website. If I'm looking for the next hour to figure out if I can play tennis or baseball, I'm on the radar. So it's that's how I do it, too.
Okay. There you go, Joel. Thank you. Thomas in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. I was just wondering, I was out for a walk and I found a weather balloon, and it looked like it had some complicated electronic instruments on it, and it had a little box, and it said, if found, return to NOAA. And I mailed it in, but unfortunately I didn't hear anything back. I was just wondering what all they use those balloons for. I know there's that is a broad question, but I was just hoping to find a little bit of information about where it possibly was or what it was used for. I was just wondering if they do ever write back to the person who found it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if they do. I know that the instrument package you found is valuable. It costs money, and it's taxpayer money that's spent to buy it. Many of them are just lost. So it's great that you found one and sent it back. And it records the temperature, the humidity, and the location of the balloon, both in the vertical and in the horizontal dimensions. And so you can track where the balloon is, and you get an idea of the winds by tracking it that way. So it measures all those things, some directly, some indirectly. I don't know if the Weather Service or NOAA ever writes back to a return address, let's say, if you put it on the box. That's a great idea. They should do that. And I wonder if they even keep track of how many they retrieve. So I can't imagine, actually, now that I think of it, that they don't do that. They at least keep track of the ones that come back. But I don't know. Steve, you know more than that?
No, I don't. But I'm surprised, too. And I think the head of the National Weather Service is an alum of the University of Wisconsin. Mm. And I think the next time we see him, we should certainly bring this up.
Yeah,
if they don't
agree.
Do it, they should. I mean, it's a first-class stamp just to say thank you.
No, right. Well, yeah, or you know, or at least put in when you return this, put your email address in, and we can email you something back, and that's even quicker and less costly than sending a letter.
I agree, and that's the definition of being a responsible United States citizen, though, right there, is sending that thing back, because it's not cheap. And it's, you know, it's just, you could just easily throw it away, but it's great that you sent it back, and you should get rewarded for that. I agree, Steve. We should talk to him about that.
Thomas, you're going to, you've got a couple of guys you're going to talk with the person in charge.
Yeah.
So there you go. Glad you called. Boy, Wendy in Appleton wonders why she often finds that there are clouds overhead outside when the radar shows clear skies, especially when she heads to the beach. What are the limitations of radar to show overcast?
So the radars are really looking at precipitation. So you could have a socked in overcast cloud bank, and the precipitation radars won't pick that up. They're designed not to measure cloud cover. They're designed to only measure precipitation or fog. They do fog as well if they turn the radar into a different sensitivity mode.
Yeah. Because we don't care if it's cloudy and you get your beach day ruined. We want you to know if it's raining or snowing outside.
No, that's right. If you want to know it's cloudy, I'll look at the satellite image.
Yeah.
There you go. And on that happy note, we are out of time. Guys, thank you so much. John, thank you for being with us the whole 90 minutes. And Steve, thanks for joining in for the second half. And you'll be back the last Monday of next month, and we'll do it all over again. Thanks to John Martin and Steve Ackerman, John Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. I'll plug his book once more. It's Reginald Sutcliffe and the Invention of Modern Weather System Science. It was a lot of fun talking with him about Reginald Sutcliffe, for sure. And it was fun talking with Steve, as well as John and Steve answered your weather questions, and they'll be back the last Monday of next month. We'll do it all over again. Tomorrow we'll talk about your pet's behavior. We'll also learn about an animal rescue organization based out of Dane County that works to find permanent homes for animals in need. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mailer.